In this episode, we explored a fascinating story of the infamous highwayman who for hundreds of years plagued Britain's roads, preying on unsuspecting travellers, often with deadly consequences. But what we're going to explore is the real story behind this, as well as the romanticised profession. Who were best known among that group, and how did they come to write their names in the folklore of British history? Hello, my name is Gareth Edwards, and welcome to the Untitled History Podcast. Join me each week alongside world-leading experts as we take a deep dive into your favourite topics from throughout history. From the ancient world to the modern, and with plenty of historical rabbit holes in between, we'll cover famous and not so famous moments in history from all across the globe. And with me today is Dan Hill from our sister podcast, Not So Quiet on the Western Front. Dan, we are both Shire boys, aren't we? Which means we grew up in various ways and lived along the Great North Road, and that's going to become relevant. And I think that's maybe a bit why we're both a bit fascinated with highwaymen, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Hi, Gareth, by the way. Just to clarify, that is Shire boys, i.e. from a Shire, one of the English Shires. Could be Cambridgeshire, could be Bedfordshire. In our case, I think it's both of us, Hertfordshire, if you're from anywhere else in the world. But effectively from the counties that typically surround London on the northern outskirts there, which as it happens is kind of key highwayman territory. And I suppose that's probably both where we get our interest from.
I think so. I think it's kind of impossible to grow up in those places. And you've got to remember that the period we're talking about, which we'll get into in a bit, it's very much about the dawn of the age of travel. And that travel is always between London and somewhere else. And that means it was always traveling through the places where you and I grew up. We grew up in an area where almost every kind of big pub or inn has a story about a highwayman who stayed there. But before we get into that, we should probably talk a little bit about what is the age of the highwayman? When does it start, Dan, really?
Well, and I suppose also what is a highwayman is probably another good point that we should address early doors.
Yeah.
Because, you know, for various people, it means various different things. The short and very, very simple explanation is a highwayman is somebody that robs people. Somebody that typically, and this is the kind of classic image, somebody that hangs about on the side of a road, jumps out with a mask on some kind of tall horse, bristling with pistols, and says, "Give me all your cash." That's in effect what the romantic picture of a highwayman is. Of course, the reality is in some cases very different to that. But the time period we're talking about as well, I mean, this is quite a tricky one. So the term itself is believed to have been first coined about 1617. It's the first time we can really see a written reference to somebody called a highwayman, which is describing that kind of activity. Obviously, being robbed at the side of the road by somebody on a horse with a load of pistols or swords or whatever it is predates that quite significantly. The concept itself is probably thousands of years old. There was someone passing down Watling Street in Roman times, in Roman Britain, that got jumped by a load of thieves or robbers of some kind. That, I suppose you could call that a highway robbery. It's certainly the same kind of concept. What I suppose is quite tricky to get your head around, actually, Gareth. I'd be interested to hear what your thought on this is. You know, what makes something a highwayman? What makes somebody a highwayman rather than just a simple robber? Is there a distinction, or is it simply the fact that term comes about and it's quite easy for us to then package that into a concept?
I think it's a good question, and I think it's something that a lot of people don't really fully understand. As you say, when we think of a highwayman, we have this vision of a single man on a horse doing a hold up in some way. He's got a mask on. He's probably got a pistol he's pointing. We'll get into a lot of the mechanics of that lately. But really, what makes a highway robber, a highwayman, a thing, certainly in that sort of 17th century, is that they are stopping coaches. They are stopping high value targets, really, and they are robbing them. And they're often doing it with a gang. So this is a very deliberate exercise. It's almost like the equivalent of a modern bank job, but with people. So we talk about bank robbers differently from how we talk about people who just rob shops. And it's a similar thing here. You will still have people described as burglars, as thugs, and many of the most famous highwaymen actually start out that way. But they almost graduate up to this highway robbery type things because it's much more organized. It is effectively a form of organized crime. And I think that's the real distinction here.
Yeah, and it's actually much more lucrative as well. It's funny how there's a pecking order between criminals, you know, the kind of petty footpad pickpockets, which is basically the same footpad is basically the same thing, just you haven't got a horse. A highwayman is a very similar thing, except you're specifically targeting high value targets, which of course comes with higher risk, comes potentially with higher rewards as well. So there's a slight pecking order as far as that kind of thing goes. It's also worth noting as well for our listeners, particularly in the United States, of course, this thing is not unique to Britain, and it's not unique to the 17th century. We see the same thing with people robbing trains in the Wild West. We see all of these kind of things going on. You see it in South America in poor places now, where you get a version of extortion that is effectively highway robbery. So, you know, this kind of concept has been around for a very, very long time and is still with us today. I think what's interesting is the conditions, particularly in Britain at that time, which create this kind of situation, because there's something of a perfect storm in terms of kind of technological revolution or technological improvements, along with a large population of dissatisfied people who are in need of earning a crust, to use a kind of fairly standard phrase at the time, need to earn some money in order to live. And, you know, those two things cross paths really on the literal paths leading out of London.
Yeah, they do. And the year you mentioned at the beginning, there's a reason the phrase is coined roughly around 1677. And that's because there's a very big and traumatic event for the three kingdoms, for England, Ireland, and Scotland, that happened very shortly before. And that is the English Civil War, also known as the War of the Three Kingdoms. This had raged for a long time in the battle between the Cavaliers and the Roundheads, the King and Parliament. And what that creates in its aftermath is a lot of ex-soldiers on both sides who are now out of work in an economy that's not great, in a country that still is very traumatized and relatively lawless in places. And that creates a fertile breeding ground for highway robbery. But as you say, none of this would be possible without the tools of the trade. And there's one tool in particular, I think, that is so critical to that. And I think we both know what I'm talking about, don't we, Dan?
Yeah, it's got to be firearms. It's, you know, it's one of those things that it's the great leveler of the time. You might not be a particularly gifted swordsman, and then, you know, you might have some problems if you get involved in highway robbery, particularly if you have to use it. Because of course, you know, as we get this kind of tit for tat nature, you start getting people who now travel with armed escorts, and armed escorts who know what they're doing. But if you can point a pistol at somebody's head, you don't necessarily need to fire it, but you tend to get the point across quite effectively. So that is one of the things that absolutely, you know, we can be using. And you know, we'll come back to you maybe on this in a second, Gareth, in terms of just how exactly pistols are used and how many of them are used. It's also worth mentioning that at the same time that we've also had some big developments with the kind of turnpike system of roads, improvement in travel generally, that's now meant that there's more mobility on a more regular basis up and down roads. Basically, there's more opportunity.
There's more opportunity, and I think it's probably good for listeners to think of them as the birth of what we would now call motorways in the UK, interstates in the US, highways, as the name suggests. Yeah. It's these dedicated paths that most people are using because you've got heavier coaches, you've got to get to places quicker. So it's easier for a highwayman to now know where a coach will be to ambush them. And so there's a swings and roundabouts as a benefits and negatives to the highway system. And as you say, the turnpike system is really where the allocation of certain sections of roads are given to private companies in order to maintain those roads. And at the end of those roads, you will literally have a gate across the road. And if you want to get through that gate, there'll be a little old man who toddles out of his cabin, you give him a few coins and he opens the gates and goes away. And that is the toll road system. That is the turnpike system that comes into play. But yeah, so you've got this combination of opportunity. It's easier for people to know where to ambush coaches. This is why so much of it happens on, say, Hampstead Heath, which at that point is a big open area just outside London. Now it's part of London. You've got the weapons in the form of flintlock pistols in particular. And you've got the people who are in a position to do it, which is those ex-soldiers, people who are out of work, people who are in an economically depressed area. And this is before the birth, really, of centralized law enforcement, and that plays a huge part as well.
Yeah, and I think a key thing, particularly about the people that are committing these crimes, is they're also trained to use weapons, know how to use them, know how to do things like lay ambushes. know how to escape afterwards. You know, all of these kind of things really play into account. And a lot of that comes back to this experience of soldiery. And of course, in a very violent time, it's worth mentioning the United Kingdom, as well as most of Europe and most of the known world at that time, is extremely violent by today's standards. You know, there's all kinds of risks and dangers associated. And in fact, the punishments that are associated with being caught conducting a highway robbery are absolutely astronomical again. And no doubt we'll come on to that as we as we go through the story. It's worth addressing for a minute, at least this concept of romanticism, you know, this romantic idea of the highway robber. We've all seen it before. It's the idea of this kind of dashing individual with a black cloak, you know, flapping in the wind on a big steaming horse in the middle of the night that comes up and robs the bloke and is extremely chivalrous to the lady, and everybody kind of is on their side. It's got a bit of a Robin Hood feel about it to me.
Yeah, and this, I think, gets to the folklore element of all of this. There is a long tradition in Britain of idolizing outlaws because they represent something outside the system. They represent people who are doing it that way. And as you say, Robin Hood is the big progenitor of that. Like, it still remains such a huge cultural figure in that regard. But even earlier, we've lost the memory of some of the people who are in similar ways. Hereward the Wake is a similar figure. He is a Saxon rebel who fights against William the Conqueror and becomes this legend in his own right. Britain's history is full of folklore around these people, and they become local legends, and the local bit's important. Most of them remain very famous locally. It's only a few like Robin Hood that burst out. And maybe actually one of the reasons that highwaymen become these figures is there's never any doubt that they're criminals. They're not robbing the rich to give to the poor. They're just robbing the rich. But what they are doing is living outside the law in an era where actually a lot of people are just feeling a bit put upon. And like, they don't have an option to do anything different. And I think that really contributes to their myth of the highwayman. And a lot of it is myth.
Yeah, and definitely come on to that. I just want to pick up on a one word that you just mentioned there, which is outlaw. Because it's perhaps not commonly known, but that's a specific term with very real points actually attached to it. You know, you are quite literally outlawed. You were expelled from the protections offered by the law, which today, you know, is a very controversial term. You know, some people don't even see that as being a thing, but absolutely the law does offer protections against you. It says, for example, if somebody murders you or attempts to murder you or robs you or anything like that, the law will punish them. If you're an outlaw, that's not true. If you're an outlaw, you are fair game to anybody at that time period. Robin Hood, he's what, I forget now, 12th century, 13th century, something like that. So significantly earlier than what we're talking about. But being outlawed was a very real and dangerous thing. You know, you're in all kinds of trouble if you get outlawed in Britain in the 17th, 16th, 17th century. So, you know, there's a lot of things about that. The myth element, I think, is extremely interesting because the reality is that most highway robberies are not somebody on a horse called Brown Bess who comes up and is very polite to you, or someone with a suave French accent that we'll talk about in a moment. Chances are it's going to be a group of young thugs who are probably going to give you a damn good kick in at the very least. You may get shot, you may get killed, you're certainly going to lose any valuables you've got, and you're probably going to be utterly terrified during the entire experience. Not a very nice thing.
Yeah, in fact, I think it's worth us exploring the actual mechanics of how highway robbery happens, because the vision that most people have of this is frankly completely wrong. So what I'm going to do now, listeners, is absolutely tell you how to execute a perfect highway robbery. Obviously, do not do this at home, but if you feel the need to time travel back to 17th century Britain and give it a go, do let us know in the comments how you get on with it. But I'm now going to tell you how to execute the perfect highway robbery. First thing you need is you need at least 6 flintlock pistols. Everything in Hollywood will show you these highwaymen running around with one pistol. You can't do anything with a single pistol. These are single shot weapons and they take bloody ages to reload, and good luck doing it on horseback. So you need 6 of them. You will have 4 pistols coupled to the front of your saddle. You will have them holstered. These pistols might be relatively large bore, and that means they've got a wide barrel because they can get a big shot out, because these are your ones that are really designed to make sure that the coach stops. They are there to suggest you are going to do a lot of damage. You will also then need at least 2 more, probably strapped to your person. These might be dueling pistols, which are smaller. They're in theory more accurate. These are your weapons for if you really need to do targeted attack once you've done it. And you also need at least three or ideally four members of your gang. And the logic on that is pretty obvious when you think about it. Because if you want to stop a coach, and remember these coaches have four horses, they are large things, they are moving at speed. The only way you're stopping it is if you're standing in front of it, if you move your horse in front of them. So you have to maneuver your horse in front of the coach and pull your pistol to make the coach stop. If there's only one of you, well, to get the money out of people and to make sure the guard doesn't attack you, because there will be a guard if this is a male coach in particular, you've got to move your horse to the side. If you move your horse to the side, that coach is gone. You're not getting that coach back. So you need at least three of you. You need one to guard the guard, who will be sat on the back. They will have a blunderbuss with them, so you definitely want a giant shotgun of a weapon. So you need someone watching them. You need someone watching the driver and standing in front of the coach. And you then need someone to go around and collect the money and make sure the passengers don't do anything silly. So this is why, generally speaking, every highwayman you'll hear about, and some of the ones we'll talk about in a minute, they all operated with gangs. They might not be named gangs, but they would always have gangs. And this is often how they're caught eventually, is because, as with any criminal enterprise, the more people that are involved in it, the easier it is eventually for the authorities to track them down and stop them. So remember, if you're going to time travel back, people, and you are going to attack a coach, do take some friends with you.
And a load of pistols as well. A good solid advice there, Gareth. Thank you for that. That's really interesting. It's also worth mentioning, of course, not everybody has the means to do that. And some people are simply opportunists. And it's not only coaches that are being robbed. There's, you know, there are poor people robbing other poor people. You know, farm boys coming back from market day on a farm cart, maybe got a few coins in their pocket from selling a couple of bales of hay or maybe a sheep. Legitimate targets in some cases. You know, it comes back to this pecking order to a certain extent. You know, I think some of the really best known highwaymen are not going to be stopping people like that. Let them go, because the risk is still high. You know, you don't know if that farm lad's got a pocket pistol or a blunderbuss or happens to be carrying some kind of other weaponry. So, you know, unless you're really sure that you're going to be able to do the job, let them go. That being said, there are, of course, people who try their luck with whatever, you know, and it's also, you know, as you said earlier, it's an economically depressed time. There are people who desperately, this might be, the money you're taking might not be to, you know, to buy some luxurious piece of item. It might be so you can have dinner that night. You know, there's some real considerations to be made. And one example of a highway robbery, it takes place in fairly early, actually, 1677. This is the testimony at court of a man by the name of John Mawson, and this is what he has to say. As I was coming home, in company with Mr. Andrews, within two fields of the new road is the By Gatehouse of Lord Baltimore. We were met by two men. They attacked us both. The man who attacked me, I've never seen since. He clapped a bayonet to my breast and said, with an oath, "Your money or your life." He had on a soldier's waistcoat and breeches. I put the bayonet aside and gave him my silver, about 3 or 4 shillings. Now, 3 or 4 shillings isn't a huge amount of money there, Gareth. It probably is. You know, it's at least a meal and it's maybe some board for a few nights. But these guys got to be out on the road again pretty soon after, because you're not, you know, you can't live for very long on that amount of money.
And this is actually one of the reasons gangs organize and why they target coaches, because in a weird sort of inversion, in this period, you're more likely to be caught or hunted down if you're targeting people lower down the pecking order than if you're targeting people at the top of the chain. And that's because we are in the era before police forces exist. Effectively, at this point, law enforcement is a very local effort. It happens almost on a parish level in Britain. So you're very, think town, you know, tiny town level if you're listening from the US. And that would be very similar to, again, how we think about the Wild West. The town might have a sheriff. They might have one person who is paid a small stipend to do some kind of law and order maintenance. But more likely, what happens is you go to your family, you go to your brothers, you go to your friends. And then you hunt down the people who did it, and then you hand them over to the justice of the peace, to the court system to deal with, probably, as you said earlier, after a bit of a kicking. But that means that actually, weirdly, targeting people lower down the economic chain is more likely to get you a reaction from local people, because that you're attacking their mates, you're attacking their family. If you're attacking a coach, you're attacking someone who's traveling through the area. You're not attacking someone who, frankly, the local sheriff is really going to care about. And that you're attacking rich people. I think for context for people here, the price of a coach ticket between, say, London and York in this period is roughly equivalent to the price of a first-class plane ticket today. So that's the kind of people that are in these coaches, and that's why they're such an attractive target to the gangs that come together around highwaymen.
And, you know, we see a number of these kind of, if you like, top-end highwaymen come to the fore, and some of them really put their stamp onto this particular profession. All of them, of course, come from other backgrounds. But one particular character is a Frenchman, actually, by the name of Claude Duval, who's perhaps best known of the early highwaymen. Born in 1643, he's working, actually, for Restoration Royalists after Charles II returns to Britain. He's kind of perhaps, let me know if you think any different here, Gareth, really the character who begins this romantic myth, although perhaps in his case it's not quite a myth, of the chivalric highwayman. Reportedly, Duval is never violent, extremely chivalrous to women during robberies, possibly, as we said, the invention of this romantic highwayman. He would rob passing stagecoaches, particularly in around London, so Highgate and Islington, which today are certainly not parks or open terrain, but they were back then. So never uses violence, describes actually as flirting with women during robberies, even with the husband there. And it's worth remembering, of course, that there's a power imbalance there to a certain extent. I think one of the things about Duval particularly is he is not violent, doesn't really even use the threat of violence apart from his appearance in a particularly worrying situation. Certainly he's armed, but he's not necessarily being overtly aggressive towards people. He actually makes his big mistake, really, is he robs what turns out to be a very influential character close to London, which is again another problem because that's where this particular character's influence is. It's the master of the Royal Buckhounds. As a result, a massive reward gets put out asking for this very distinctive chivalric Frenchman who turns out to be very well known in the area. He's actually flees to France himself and then comes back to London and gets captured in a pub in Covent Garden called the Hole in the Wall Tavern. And he's sentenced to death 17th of January 1670. For six robberies, and he's executed at the famous Tyburn Tree. What's really interesting, actually, is very close to that location. There's even today, I don't know if you've ever seen this guy, there's a plaque in London which refers specifically to this character, and I'll read the poem here, or I'll give it a go at least. Here lies Duval, reader. If male thou art, look to thy purse. If female, to thy heart. Much havoc he has made of both. For all men he made to stand, and women he made to fall. The second conqueror of the Norman race. Knights to his arm did yield, and ladies to his face. Old Tyburn's glory, England's illustrious thief, Duval. The lady's joy, Duval, the lady's grief.
Duval fascinates me because he's the first one, I think, that realizes everything we've talked about already. He innately gets that actually he's got his gang. He does this stuff with his gang. If he can promote himself as almost this Robin, half a Robin Hood, the man who takes, doesn't give, but takes, that if he does that, he's not going to get a lot of opposition in the local communities he's passing through, because all he's doing is doing something to the toffs. And what he also realizes is that if he can turn being robbed into a bit of a social thing, a bit of a thing that you can talk about to your rich friends and talk about at parties, then he's going to have an easier time of robbing rich people. So he almost gets the media narrative of what you need if you're a highwayman. He's an influencer. He's having pamphlets published about himself. He's making sure his image is there. And I think that's really, really notable about him, is he does set that template. It's why he comes to define so much of the public perception of what a highwayman is because he's a very smart guy who knows how to absolutely minimize the chances that anyone's going to try and catch him. And I think that's really, really important in terms of what he does. And it's exactly why he comes a cropper the first time he robs a genuinely important rich person who goes, I don't care about telling this story at parties. You took my money. I want you hunted down.
Yeah, and loses his life for it as well. So apparently even polite and chivalrous on the scaffold as he makes his way up to Tyburn there. So quite a character by all accounts. But, you know, there are others out there as well. And one that I want to mention really briefly is a guy by the name of William Clibborn, who is from our neck of the woods, Gareth, where you and I both come from, in Hertfordshire. He's around during the late 18th century, and there were a series of robberies on the quiet country roads outside the county town of Hertford. These were specifically targeted attacks, and they were noted at the time as being targeted attacks of merchants that had done particularly well in the market that day. So this is guys going home to their home parish or the home village after a busy day at Hertford Market, selling their wares, whatever it might be, and they're going home with a pocket full of cash, and it's quite clear that that's the case. And they would be set upon on their way home. They would be robbed, usually at knife point, although occasionally at gunpoint. And on the 28th of December 1782, the gang struck again, robbing a farmer's son who was driving his cart through woods near Datchworth. This is a little village just outside of that area. What's particularly interesting is exactly what you've just described. And this is part of the problem with robbing farmer's boys, because instead of going and try and finding local, you know, local lawmaker or somebody that could maybe come and apprehend these guys, he goes and gets his uncle and his brother. And his uncle and his brother pick up a firearm each, and they say, right, not having that, we're going back. That was all of the money that we had. We're not rich people. We can't just write this off and say, oh, this is okay. We're going to go back and take our revenge. And what they do is they make their way back to the spot where the not very bright highwaymen are still around. They've actually been robbing people in the same spot for like 3 weeks in a row. So everybody knows that these guys are around the area. They find them still there, and they shoot and kill the leader of the highwaymen. They actually eventually will capture one of the sons. Turns out it's a son. And the other guy, the third guy, will escape. What they then find out is they unmask this fella, this kind of unknown assailant, and everybody knows him. He's like one of the best known faces at Hertford Market because he's the pie man from the Hertford Market. This guy, for weeks and months, has been going around the market all day with his two sons selling pies to people. He's like, he's an absolute, everybody knows this fella, the Clibborn. And what he's actually been doing, he's been getting his sons to scope out who's been doing really well on the sales in the market, finishes selling his pies at the end of the day, packs his stuff up, leaves it in Hertford, gets out on a horse and goes and hides and then robs them on the way home, goes back and picks up his pie stuff, and he's back there again the next week or the next month. It's incredible. It's exactly what happens. As it turns out, you know, this guy is buried at the side of the road. And there's a great Hertfordshire folklore story here I have to share with you quickly, Gareth. There's a post there at the spot where this last incident takes place. And it's called Clibborn's Post. Maybe the guys can chuck an image up of it on screen for us right now. Clibborn's Post is supposedly driven through the heart of the highwayman so his spirit can never escape, and it's still there at the side of the road. The story goes that it's never never been released. In fact, we know, weirdly, me being a First World War historian, we know in 1914, just before the outbreak of war, there's a guy called Joseph Clibborn, who's in the Hertfordshire Regiment. They're going along in an early truck, a vehicle, and it gets bogged in the side of the road. And all the lads locally are trying to get this van out of the area. And they say, oh, Clibborn, you know, that post over there has got your name on it. Go and get it out of the ground. And they use Clibborn's Post actually to jimmy this lorry wheel free and then carry on about their day. So the post at least comes out of the ground once. In fact, Clibborn is killed on the Somme, believe it or not. But amazing kind of local story, but really gives you an idea, as you've described. You know, you've got to be careful who you pick.
And I think you hit on something we should talk a bit about. Well, two things, really. The first of those is complicit trademen. And the second we'll get onto a bit is the importance of horses. But let's talk about tradesmen, because actually, if you are a highwayman or a highway robbery gang, you are going to have to move up and down the country to do this. Or as Dan's just highlighted, if you stay in one area too long, you will get caught. And one of the reasons you'll get caught at that point is because, technically speaking, the local parish is liable for any of the money you steal. Now, your aristocrats don't generally go to the local parish officers to try and get their money back, because that would almost be like admitting that you needed the money. But your local people will. So if you keep stealing from the same parish, not only are you going to get someone's brothers come down on you, you're also then you're costing that parish money, and that parish really cares. But what this means is you've got to keep moving. To keep moving, you kind of need to know where you should be robbing and where you should be not robbing. But you also need things like access to places to stay, to hideouts. You need tip-offs, which means that there's a lot of talk within the press at the time, and a lot of suspicion that your various inn owners are either highwaymen themselves, so they will put someone up for the night, and then as they leave the next day, they'll don the mask and go off and rob them because they know exactly who was staying and how much they're worth. Or that stable hands are doing this. They're tipping people off. So if you're a highwayman, you probably want to be nice to your stable hands in these inns and these coaching inns that you're staying at, because you want them, when you're passing through, you want them to be able to come to you and say, Dan, there's a couple of really rich guys staying here tonight. They're the guys in they're not in the main mail coach. They've got their own private coach, and they're going to be leaving about an hour after the mail coach. So don't rob the mail coach. Hang back and go for the one that's following it, because it's got your high value targets in. And then you'll chuck him a few coins. And those people have got to be very careful, because if they're caught, the community really comes down on them. But it can actually be quite lucrative being almost a snitch for highwaymen as much as anything else.
That's interesting, actually. And, you know, the idea of effectively having eyes all over the place is something that certainly happens. It's also worth mentioning, you know, it's not out of the question for highwaymen to rob or deceive other highwaymen. I'm sure that happened on multiple occasions, you know. Yep, let somebody go and do the hard work. Well, why rob those five people? Let this guy do it and let's just rob him afterwards. You know, there's not this kind of chivalry between highwaymen that we sometimes, honor amongst thieves, it's sometimes called. You know, it's a pretty cutthroat world and, you know, the risks are super high. In fact, the risks are very high because really there's no limit as to who will get robbed. In fact, in some point, I think about the mid-18th century, the British Prime Minister is held up by highwaymen. And goes back and makes a big speech to Parliament about it, explaining this scourge. There's been a huge explosion over a period of about 100 years, which, interestingly, Gareth, actually aligns roughly with the kind of the golden age of piracy. And I wonder if there's any kind of connection between those two things, do you think?
I think there is. I think what we're into is a period of societal change on a grand scale. You know, we're into that period of Napoleonic Wars, of the birth of industry, of changing country as a whole. And it's that level of disruption that's very similar in a way to that disruption that we talked about at the end of the War of the Three Kingdoms, the end of the English Civil War. And whenever you have periods of grand upheaval, you get unrest, you get changes in how the law works, you get changes in what falls through the gaps in crime terms and what's possible and what's not. If you think back to the birth of mobile phones, when mobile phones started appearing, the huge rush of mobile phone thefts that kicked in until police forces around the world started working out how to deal with them. Because suddenly there was almost a new crime that was hard for people to identify and catch people doing. And there weren't necessarily laws on the statute books to deal with it. And really, it's that period, that golden age, where you get that both at sea and on land, I think. And we see legislation changes around what is illegal and what the punishments are. I think it's worth pointing out that by the end of that golden age, there are two very clear capital offences that apply specifically to highway robbery. And one of those is, if you murder someone, you are getting executed. But also, if you steal a horse, you are liable to be executed as well. Horse theft is a capital offence in Britain by the end of this period. And that's important because highwaymen need to steal horses to operate. You can't really own and operate your own horse, because if you're a highway gang, because you need fast horses. That means you need well-bred horses. And horses are really distinct. They're really unique. They have their own natural markings, but they also often have their ears clipped by an owner, or they'll have markings that are put on them by branding or similar. So think of what highwaymen are doing in this period. They almost need the 19th century equivalent of a sports car to do these robberies. They can't afford to buy their own sports cars and then keep buying new sports cars because the sports cars are really identifiable and obvious. So they have to steal horses. And this is again why having complicit stable hands is useful. You want to know when an inn's got some good horses in. But this is one clear reason why they make horse theft a capital offence, because it gives you a very, very easy way of making sure that you can deliver the maximum penalty to any highwayman you catch without having to track down all of their victims that they've stolen money from, do complex things about the value of what they've stolen, have lengthy court proceedings. You can just go, who did you steal that horse from? We found the owner of that horse. They've confirmed you've stolen that horse. Welcome to the gallows.
And actually, it's going to be that very crime is going to see the end of perhaps the most famous of all highwaymen, which we'll come on to in a minute. I know, Gareth, you've done a bit of research. A really interesting point that you made there with regard to highwaymen. It's just worth reinforcing, I think, to a certain extent. You need a fair amount of money to set up as a legitimate highwayman, more specifically as a highway robbery gang. you can't just turn up and say, well, this is going to be my profession from now on. Talking sports cars, you got a gang of four. You need four sports cars of the time. Four very expensive to keep, expensive to run sports cars in the form of, you know, decent horses. Each of your gang needs a handful of pistols. You need places that everybody can sleep. You need to pay for your meals. In short, highway robbery gangs have a lot of overheads. You know, this is part of the reason why you need a big score and you tend to need one quickly. And that's why the risk goes up. And that's why people get more aggressive, more violent, because the stakes just raise so high. If you're a highway robbery gang and you go a week or 2 weeks without conducting a successful robbery, all of a sudden you're tapping your pockets looking for the money to pay for that evening's meal or that evening's board and accommodation. You haven't got it. What do? Do you sell one of your horses? Well, you can't because they're stolen. You know, how do you go about this stuff? So the stakes are really high. And I think one great example of this, somebody who makes his way up from those lower ranks into the higher ranks, probably the famous name when it comes to the story of highwaymen throughout any period of history, it's got to be the famous or infamous Dick Turpin.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, Dick Turpin is the name related to highway robbery that everyone, certainly in Britain, will think of if you mention that name. You know, if you're listening from America, think of him as sort of Britain's Jesse James. It's that kind of thing. That's the level we're talking at in terms of fame. And Turpin's born in Essex, so just outside of London in 1705. And he starts actually on a lot of that path we've talked about. He's a petty criminal. No, he actually starts working as a butcher's apprentice. He's a butcher's son. And actually his introduction to the world of theft and highway robbery and everything else is because he starts dealing in stolen meat for one of the gangs that's operating in the area called the Essex Gangs. They're going out, they're poaching deer, they're robbing local farmers on their way to and from market. Now they've got goods. They need to sell those goods. They need to fence those goods. And actually, that's how Turpin gets into it. He starts buying this illegal game and this illegal meat off of them. And that's how he gets to know the gang. And he works up from there. Then they kind of take him along on some burglaries and he starts doing a bit of light burglary. He starts breaking into houses with the gang and they start threatening the owners until they reveal the location of their valuables. They're really nasty stuff, really. No, you're talking like home invasions where they hold a farmer's family hostage until the farmer reveals where all of his goods are. What they realize though very, very quickly is, as everything we've talked about already, if you do that to a local community, the local community reacts. You haven't got the mobility to deal with it. And so you end up with this large manhunt that leads to the capture of the gang. Most of the gang get caught, and Turpin at that point goes, well, I've earned enough startup capital now. I've got enough banked away that I might as well move into highway robbery, as exactly as you say, Dan. And that happens in roughly May 1737. And he starts really being active in the London area. But ultimately, that's what does him in, isn't it? Because he's there a bit too long.
Absolutely. And I'm going to let you continue with that story shortly, Gareth, because I know you know that particular incident so much better than I do. I just want to point something out, though, here, right at this point, because I think it's makes sense, particularly with Turpin, but also with a number of these characters. And let's be fair, we're not talking about master criminals here. Some people make stupid choices, and you could argue that being a highwayman is a pretty stupid choice in the first place. You could argue, you know, any number of things, but these people are not well-educated university students that have gone bad. These are generally rough and ready people brought up from the lower ranks of society who have rolled the dice and they take risks and perhaps possessed with plenty of personal bravery and personal courage in that sense, but not really people to follow in terms of moral compass or in terms of intelligence. In fact, the way that Turpin is eventually going to get caught prior to his death is particularly stupid. He writes a letter to his brother and signs it with his real name, having been under an alias. The letter gets intercepted and that's the end of him. But before we get to that point, it's worth pointing out, of course, the story goes on and he has several brushes with the law before we reach there too.
Yeah, he does. I mean, in May 1737, he's hiding in Epping Forest, which is just outside of London. And he's doing that thing. He's being that not the brightest thing that we've talked about. He's stayed local. He's preying on people in the area. And actually, one of those people tracks him down there. And he shoots the servants of one of the forest keepers, so the people who oversee the area. And he doesn't move on. But he's now committed that fatal mistake that we talked about earlier with Duval. He's murdered someone important. where he's committed a crime against someone important. And this is the warrant that's issued for his arrest, actually. It says, it having been represented to the king that Richard Turpin did on Wednesday the 4th of May last barbarously murder Thomas More, servant to Henry Thompson, one of the keepers of Epping Forest, and commit other notorious felonies and robberies near London. His Majesty is pleased to promise his most gracious pardon to any of his accomplices and a reward of 200 shillings to any person or persons that shall discover him so as he may be apprehended and convicted. And this leads to Turpin having to leave the area and start becoming a vagrant at large, because now some of his own gang want him. That's a fair bit of money. So that they're quite happy to turn him in. And as you say, this ultimately leads to him being chased across the country almost. This is the reason why I always joke that the only person who seems to have stayed in more inns and hidden in more inns in England than Charles II is Dick Turpin, because you can't go anywhere on the Great North Road without a story about how Dick Turpin hid in this inn. But as you described, Dan, ultimately they managed to start zoning in on him because he writes a letter to his brother and the postman recognizes his handwriting. It's one of those things where the chances of that happening are really small, but then they start to know where he is. Now, he actually goes anonymous at this point to begin with. He starts living under the name of John Palmer, and he manages to get away with this for a while. He's actually in Beverley in Yorkshire. But as you say, these aren't the brightest people, and that Turpin starts committing low-level crime again. And it's that low-level crime that ultimately means that he's captured and available to be prosecuted. And here's how you do not expect a highwayman to end. John Palmer, as we know him as Dick Turpin, is actually jailed because he shoots another man's chicken in the street. That is the crime that leads to local enforcement sticking him in a cell, and then all of the truth comes out, as you say, with the letter. He's moved to York for trial and everything else. But his downfall starts because he shoots a chicken in the streets of Beverley. And I think that's not how you expect a highwayman's tale to sort of come towards an end, is when you've been sweeping through, robbing all these rich people, but it's shooting a man's chicken that gets you done in the end.
It's a bit of an ignominious end, isn't it? But I suspect it's probably not an unrepresentative one. You know, these kind of things, and this goes to show, I think it comes back to this idea of luck and just having the means in order to, you know, to commit these kind of crimes. Bear in mind, he's lost his gang by now. So what you described earlier, this idea of a perfect highway robbery against a high-value target, much more difficult to achieve. You know, can he now individually, as a lone character, take on something like this and manage to pull it off? Well, if the answer's no, and let's say the answer's no 3, 4, 5, 6 nights in a row, all of a sudden, this guy's not got enough money in his pocket in order to have his board, to have his meal. I'd imagine the shooting the chicken thing gives you an idea of the kind of level of desperation that he's got down to. He's not shooting a chicken because it's fun. He's shooting that because that's what he's going to eat that night. And so, you know, he's in a really desperate situation. And as you rightly said, everything kind of unravels in around York, and eventually Dick Turpin is going to meet his end. But, you know, there's something as well, and that's the legacy of the man, because, of course, he is a name that we know. But I'll be honest, everything that you've told me about Dick Turpin so far, nothing there stands out as me saying, wow, this is why we must know him. So what is it? Why do we know that name?
Because the Victorians wrote about him a lot. I mean, famously, there's the novel Rookwood, and it's that's the reason we know him, is because in the novel Rookwood, he makes a 200-mile journey from London to York in record time on his horse Black Bess. And that's why he lives on in memory, because again, it's exactly back to this Duval thing. He doesn't romanticize himself. He gets romanticized by others. And that's what leads to us knowing him more than anything else. I strongly suspect that if any of us met Dick Turpin in the street, or certainly in a pub, we would not like him, and we might not even emerge with our wallets from the encounter. But the literary version of Dick Turpin is the version that everyone loves.
And, you know, I think to kind of finish off the story of Turpin in particular, it's interesting how, you know, that fictional character and the reality get mangled together. I think you're absolutely right. You know, if you meet Dick Turpin in some kind of setting which wasn't, you know, an interview about how great Dick Turpin was, he's probably going to rob you. It's this weird phenomenon of people, you know, going to watch, I don't know, Bundy, the serial killer in court, saying, oh, look how charismatic he is. Yeah, well, change the situation. I'm pretty sure you're not going to find that same character that way. But, you know, his ending is interesting because he has gained a certain amount of notoriety during the time. We just have a small clip that kind of gives it an idea. And it says quite simply, Turpin behaved in an undaunted manner as he mounted the ladder. Feeling his right leg tremble, he spoke a few words to the topsman, then threw himself off and expired in 5 minutes. Suggesting he's already got the noose around his neck and he's climbing up for what they called a short drop at the time, which is likely to strangle you, throws himself off the scaffold. In fact, same thing, I think Guy Fawkes is said to have done that as well and broken his own neck. But, you know, it's pretty grim ending. And Dick Turpin, of course, is not the only one to end that way. And he's also not the only famous character as well, because I think we need to finish with one famous character, or characteress perhaps, in this instance, and that's Catherine Ferrers.
Yeah, I think it's important for us to mark that we've talked a lot about highwaymen here, and the majority were. But there were female members of these gangs. Women were part of these gangs too. But the myth was always about men. And some of that myth then bleeds into later on myths about women being characters around this. And Catherine Ferrers is interesting because she's a real person. So she was born in 1634 into a fiercely royalist minor aristocratic family. So she's in that exact period we're talking about. And she, I like her as an example because she's 13 when her family are all effectively killed in the Civil War. And she ends up being given as a guardian by another family. And we've talked earlier about how a lot of the reaction to highway robbery and the reason for it is trying to fight against society's norms. Well, the guardian family for Catherine, they marry her off pretty much straight away. She's married at 13 to 16-year-old fellow noble called Thomas Fanshawe. And his family take charge of her wealth. She has a substantial wealth. She has no access to it now because she's a young woman. She is now married off. It's not her wealth anymore. We don't know much about her for certain, but we do know that she does survive to see the restoration of Charles II. We've got records of her staying in London at the time, but she dies suddenly and mysteriously at the age of 26. And she's another one of our Hertfordshire ones. She's buried in Ware, a small town in Hertfordshire. And what's important about her is we don't have any real evidence that she was a highway robber. We know there were plenty of women who'd engaged in this, but she's almost become one of the more famous ones because local legends absolutely argue that she was a notorious highway robber. They say she ran a gang in the area. They say she orchestrated a number of raids and robberies over an extended period, and that this was how she was surviving when she had no money because her husband's family had wasted it all, and her husband himself was in jail by this point for being part of a royalist rebellion before the royals were restored. And I think she's worth finishing on just to highlight everything we've said so far, that all of this stuff, both in terms of the reality of it and the myth of it, comes back to that rejection of society's norms. It's about the fascination people have with those that operate outside the boundaries of society at any given time, and whether they're doing that for the greater good or whether they're doing that for themselves, that's a powerful, powerful legend to have. You've been listening to the Untitled History Podcast, a Battle Guide production. If you've enjoyed this episode and would like to support the podcast, why not head over to our dedicated supporter page? There, for the cost of a cup of tea, you can decide which subjects we cover next, get access to exclusive behind-the-scenes content, and join a community of like-minded people. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. And with me is Dan Hill. From our sister podcast, All Quiet on the Western Front.
Not so quiet, not so quiet.
And with me is Dan Hill from our sister podcast,
Not so quiet on the Western Front.
Yeah. I mean, given how much I've listened to that over the years, you'd think I'd get the name right.
You would.
But there you go, Linus, there's your first outtake.